Okay, let's unpack this. How one person became the ultimate pop idol, the Thin White Duke, and a cultural oracle. We are diving deep today into the monumental career of David Bowie, born David Robert Jones. And it's a career that spans, what, 6 decades of just constant, breathtaking
Yeah,
reinvention.
it really is. I mean, this isn't just a biography, it's a study in identity management. It
Totally.
is the ultimate lesson in artistic fluidity. You know, unlike almost every other celebrity who finds a successful formula and then just mines it for decades, Bowie's genius was that his core identity was change itself.
Right. The change was the brand.
Exactly. And so our mission today is to sift through all this extensive source material we have, detailing his life in music, acting, art, and to really isolate those key pivot points.
The aha moments.
Aha moments, yeah. The psychological and cultural drivers behind his continuous transformations and, you know, why he kept succeeding where so many others would have just crashed and burned.
And when we talk about success, I mean, the numbers are just staggering. We are talking about a man who sold well over 100 million records worldwide.
100 million. It's almost hard to comprehend.
Right. And he secured 6 Grammy Awards, 4 Brit Awards, inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame back in 96. But here's the statistic that, for me, really underlines his lasting influence.
Let's hear it.
Even in the digital age, as of 2022, David Bowie was the best-selling vinyl artist of the 21st century.
Wow. That vinyl statistic is fascinating, isn't it? Because it proves that his output, especially that early, highly visual, collectible work, it just maintains this profound connection with new
It's
generations.
tangible. You can hold it.
You can. And his influence, it didn't just stop in 1983 with Let's Dance. It's like an ongoing curriculum for popular culture. But to really understand the Starman, we have to start at the very beginning.
Back to the root.
Back to post-war Brixton, London, where David Robert Jones was born on January 8th, 1947.
Let's start there, with the seismic influences that really fractured young David Jones's life and sort of set him on this path that had to involve transformation. We know around age 9, his father brought home a collection of American 45s.
Yes, and this wasn't just casual listening. You have to picture it. This was an awakening. I mean, artists like the Platters and Elvis Presley, they definitely caught his attention.
Sure.
But the pivotal moment he cited again and again was hearing Little Richard's Tutti Frutti.
Heard God. That's what he said, right?
He famously said that listening to that song was like having heard God. That raw, you know, uncompromising energy of American rock and roll combined with the visual power he saw in early Elvis. That was his initial roadmap.
But the map wasn't only American pop. It was much more complicated by his home life. His maternal half-brother, Terry Burns, who was 10 years older, was a huge influence.
A guide, but a guide who carried some heavy baggage. Terry's influence is maybe the most critical and also the most tragic piece of Bowie's foundation.
Oh, so.
Well, Terry was the one who introduced David to the really high-minded, challenging arts. We're talking the complexities of modern jazz from Charles Mingus and John Coltrane.
Heavy stuff for a kid.
Oh, absolutely. The philosophical depth of Buddhism, the revolutionary language of beat poetry, and even the occult. But Terry was also battling schizophrenia, as were several other extended family members. Seeing that struggle unfold firsthand just profoundly shaped the young artist.
So his art was created at this collision point between what rock and roll's ecstatic release on one side and this interior paranoid anxiety linked to mental illness on the other.
Precisely. The themes of paranoia, delusion, alienation, the desperate search for identity that you see all over his early albums, like The Man Who Sold the World,
Oh.
they were directly informed by the shadow that Terry cast.
So art became a coping mechanism.
It was a way to process and maybe even wear that anxiety as a costume to make it manageable. He loved his brother dearly, but that tension between genius and madness became a recurrent motif for his entire career.
Speaking of physical appearances, we have to talk about the event that literally shaped one of his most recognizable features, his eye.
That distinctive look, the permanently dilated pupil, which is called an anisocoria in his left eye. It's an accident that was just elevated to iconic status.
Yeah, the sources confirm it was a school fight in 1962.
Over a girl, of all things.
Yeah.
And his friend, George Underwood, was the one who delivered the punch.
And it was a severe event. It resulted in 4 months of hospitalization and gave him faulty depth perception for the rest of his life.
4 months.
I find that incredible. He was hospitalized for 4 months, yet the friend who punched him goes on to design the covers of his early albums.
That level of forgiveness and, you know, that enduring creative collaboration, it just speaks volumes about the man. It shows this innate ability to take chaos or injury and transform it into a productive part of his life.
Even the eye itself.
Even that damaged eye. It gave his gaze such a mysterious alien quality, which became essential to his whole visual presentation. But as he moved through the early 60s, he was just searching. He formed the Conrads in 62, then a series of unsuccessful blues and folk outfits.
The King Bees, the Mannish Boys.
And lower third. He was trying on genres like clothes, you know, and none of them fit.
And this search for the right fit led him away from just music and straight into the theatrical. He shifted his focus to studying dramatic arts, specifically under Lindsay Kemp.
Another crucial pivot. Kemp was a master of avant-garde theater and mime, and Bowie credited meeting Kemp as the moment when his interest in image really blossomed.
So Kemp taught him how to use his body, not just his voice.
Exactly. He taught him that the stage was a canvas for movement and spectacle, not just sound. Bowie later said meeting Kemp was like having joined the circus. He learned how to command an audience with silence and gesture, not just microphone technique.
So the stage was now set for the first official act of self-creation, the name change. He's Davy Jones, but...
He had to avoid being confused with Davy Jones of the Monkees, who were massive.
Wow.
So in 1966, he adopts David Bowie, named after the 19th century American pioneer James Bowie, and the knife he popularized.
A sharp edge.
He was literally giving himself the sharpness and dangerous edge of a blade. It was a profound act of self-naming.
But even with a new persona, a sharp name, immediate success wasn't guaranteed. His debut self-titled album in 67.
A real mix of pop, psychedelia, music hall.
It failed commercially.
Yeah.
As did that famous novelty track, The Laughing Gnome.
Oh, The Laughing Gnome. Yeah, it just proves the narrative that even rock icons have these periods of outright failure.
Absolutely. And those failures pushed him toward introspection and toward his first major breakthrough at the end of the decade. He was feeling alienated after a breakup, frustrated by years of missed shots.
And he sat down and channeled all those feelings into the iconic astronaut, Major Tom.
The song was Space Oddity. And the sources show the timing of its release was either genius or just staggering luck.
It was a combination of both. It was released on July 11th, 1969, just 5 days before the Apollo 11 moon launch.
You can't make that up.
You can't. The BBC initially wouldn't play it until the mission was safely underway, but the public connection was electric. The single broke him into the UK top five, his first major hit, even though he wouldn't hit that level of success again for another 3 years.
But Major Tom immediately established his ability to connect personal anxiety with these grand universal themes.
It did. And the real seeds of the chameleon, the shapeshifter, began sprouting during the U.S. publicity tour for The Man Who Sold the World in 1971. That's where the visual shock really began to take hold.
He was desperate for attention.
Desperate, and he got it by fully embracing an androgynous look, wearing a flowing dress during interviews. The sources confirmed this immediately drew critical attention. Rolling Stone called him ravishing, reminiscent of Lauren Bacall.
He had found a way to weaponize ambiguity.
Absolutely. And more significantly, during that tour, he observed the American proto-punk scene. He saw Iggy Pop's chaotic stage persona and Lou Reed's gritty songwriting.
And a light bulb went off.
A massive one. Those observations crystallized his next identity. He decided to meld Iggy's raw, boundary-pushing stage presence with the poetic realism of Lou Reed's music, aiming to create the ultimate pop idol.
And Ziggy Stardust was born.
The concept was born. The Stardust surname, by the way, was a little tribute to a novelty act called the Legendary Stardust Cowboy. He took this tiny, obscure reference and just built an entire mythology around it.
So the stage is set for the glam rock explosion. The shift from struggling artist to cultural phenomenon happens when Ziggy Stardust finally hits the stage.
It does. The debut of the red-haired, flame-haired Ziggy Stardust persona backed by the Spiders from Mars.
Mick Ronson, Trevor Boulder, Mick Woodmansey.
Happened in February 1972 at the very unglamorous Toby Jug Pub in Tolworth. The album The Rise and Fall of Ziggy Stardust and the Spiders from Mars was instantly genre-defining. It skillfully blended the hard rock he'd been playing with on The Man Who Sold the World with the lighter acoustic pop of Hunky Dory.
And the track Starman was critical to this UK breakthrough, right? It created this unique cult of Bowie among the youth, allowing them to embrace ambiguity and theatricality.
the cultural impact was immense. Bowie was challenging societal norms of gender and sexuality through his appearance and his art. And this is the moment we really need to talk about his sexuality.
The 1972 Declaration and Melody Maker.
Yes, his public declaration of bisexuality while he was still married to Angie generated massive, massive publicity.
Was that declaration an honest reflection, though? Or was it a strategic part of the Ziggy persona designed to maximize shock value?
The sources suggest it was a very carefully deployed tactic that blurred the line between reality and art. He knew it would shock conservative Britain and America. One observer noted he mined sexual intrigue for its ability to shock.
It was crucial to his image as this nonconformist alien.
It was. And the success just kept rolling. Aladdin Sane in 1973 became his first UK number one album. He called it Ziggy Goes to America, basically documenting the craziness of the US tour.
But that total immersion in character, it came at a huge visible cost. His love of dramatic arts meant he couldn't just switch Ziggy off when he walked off stage.
The line between actor and role completely evaporated. Bowie later admitted that the role wouldn't leave me alone for years. It led him to serious doubts about his own sanity.
He described himself as a robot offstage.
A robot, exactly. Only achieving real emotion when the performance began. He was creatively succeeding, but psychologically unraveling.
And the resolution was, in typical Bowie fashion, pure theater. An abrupt, dramatic exit.
Yes. In July 1973, he ends the Ziggy Stardust tour at London's Hammersmith Odeon with the shocking announcement that he was retiring Ziggy Stardust.
He killed him.
It was a preemptive strike, closing the curtain on a character that was threatening to consume the man. Was it risky? Absolutely. He had finally achieved this stratospheric success, and he just killed it off.
But it was also genius, because it proved his commitment to transformation. He had to destroy his greatest success to survive.
And the sources confirmed the commercial momentum was entirely undeterred. His back catalog soared. Pin-ups, a covers album from later that year, hit number one. At one point, he had 6 Bowie albums concurrently on the UK chart.
He was the best-selling UK act of 1973.
He was. And that takes us to 74 and the second massive upheaval, the move to the US and the start of the drug-fueled creative chaos.
Diamond Dogs,
yeah. An album reflecting 2 main ideas, a post-apocalyptic musical, and an attempt to set Orwell's 1984 to music. It was a success, but the accompanying tour.
Captured in the documentary Cracked Actor.
Yes, and that documentary exposed the immense personal toll he was paying.
The footage is genuinely disturbing. The sources reveal a Bowie who was practically wasting away, emaciated, severely debilitated. This is when his heavy cocaine addiction, paranoia, and emotional problems really kicked in.
He was living entirely on milk, peppers, and cocaine.
Mm.
The paranoia was so intense that he reportedly kept his own urine in the refrigerator for fear that a witch might steal it.
That's extreme.
It was such a dark period that he later joked the live album, David Live, should have been titled David Bowie is Alive and Well and Living Only in Theory.
Wow. And then, following this psychological collapse, he executes another radical stylistic departure in 1975 with Young Americans.
He sheds the glam completely, immerses himself in R&B and soul, creating what he dubbed Plastic Soul.
Plastic Soul. That term is important, isn't it?
It is. It meant 2 things. First, that it was a white British artist appropriating and fusing Black American R&B sounds, sort of acknowledging its artificiality.
And second.
Second, and more profoundly, it reflected his own artificial, drug-fueled, and emotionally vacant state at the time. The album successfully alienated some of his UK fans, who felt betrayed by the shift to R&B.
But it did exactly what he needed it to do in America.
It achieved a major crossover success. It gave him his first U.S. number one hit, Fame, famously a collaboration with John Lennon.
Right.
This period successfully transitioned him from a niche glam phenomenon into a genuine transatlantic superstar.
But the addiction continued into 1976, which marks the beginning of his most chilling persona, the Thin White Duke.
The Duke was introduced on the Station to Station album. Visually, he was stark, severe, almost fascist. An extension of the character he played in the cult film The Man Who Fell to Earth.
Thomas Jerome Newton.
Exactly. And musically, it was this fascinating merger of the funk and soul he'd been playing, synthesized with the cold, driving rhythms of electronic music and German krautrock.
And this is where the persona and the addiction reached a critical mass.
Absolutely. Bowie later confessed his cocaine addiction was at its absolute peak during the Station to Station sessions. He said he remembered only flashes of its making and that his sanity was genuinely twisted.
The 10-minute title track, references the drug directly.
It does, and he began referring to himself as King Arthur, requiring a full-time occult manager.
The public actions during the Isolar tour that followed were equally shocking. We have to discuss the serious political controversy.
It was explosive. There was the detention at the Russian-Polish border for possessing alleged Nazi paraphernalia. More infamously, there was the Victoria Station incident in London.
The photograph.
He arrived in an open-top Mercedes. A photograph captured him making a gesture. And while Bowie insisted the photographer caught him mid-wave, it was widely published and interpreted as a Nazi salute.
And this was coupled with incendiary public statements. He was quoted saying Britain could benefit from a fascist leader and even called Adolf Hitler one of the first rock stars.
Yeah.
The backlash was immense.
It was. He later retracted and apologized for those pro-fascism comments, attributing them entirely to his overwhelming cocaine addiction, the influence of the Thin White Duke character, and the toxic environment of LA that had warped his perception of reality.
And he spent the rest of his life using his platform to condemn racism.
He did. The irony is that those shocking quotes, alongside similar comments by Eric Clapton, became one of the catalysts for the establishment of the Rock Against Racism movement.
Having created and then barely survived the Thin White Duke, Bowie made his most decisive escape yet. He blamed Los Angeles, a city he later said should be wiped off the face of the earth, and in August 76, he moved to the anonymity of West Berlin.
And he took Iggy Pop with him. This was a move explicitly designed to battle their mutual drug addictions and find some kind of artistic cleansing.
And this escape led to one of the most intellectually rigorous periods of his life, the Berlin Trilogy.
The Trilogy, the albums Low, Heroes, and Lodger. All co-produced with Tony Visconti and heavily influenced by the compositional structures of Brian Eno.
For the listener who might not be steeped in 1970s European experimental music, can you just quickly ground us in what krautrock and the Eno collaboration meant for the sound?
Absolutely. Krautrock, pioneered by bands like Kraftwerk and New, was characterized by relentless, motoric rhythms, electronic textures, and a rejection of traditional blues rock song structures. Eno was the perfect partner, known for his ambient, minimalist approach.
And the first album, Low, was structured around this synthesis, right? A side of song fragments and a B-side of ambient soundscapes.
Exactly. And RCA was clearly unnerved by this. After the U.S. success of Fame, this was a radical departure.
They were terrified.
They delayed the release of Low for 3 months, deeming it not commercially viable. And ironically, Low wasn't even recorded mostly in Berlin. It was mostly France. But it was the first fruit of his intellectual movement away from pop.
And he had already tested the waters with Iggy Pop's album, The Idiot.
He produced it as a stepping stone to test out the new sounds and the sobriety-driven focus he needed. And despite RCA's concerns, Low was a critical and commercial hit, reached number 2 in the UK.
Then the second album, Heroes, also in 77, was the only one of the trilogy recorded entirely in Berlin at Hansa Studios overlooking the wall.
Right. And this album incorporated pop and rock elements more heavily. It features the remarkable guitar work of Robert Fripp. And the title track, of course, which immortalized a pair of lovers meeting by the wall, became one of his best-known songs globally.
An anthem of desperate, impossible romance.
It really is. And this era was also where we find one of the most bizarre and charming anomalies in his career.
You mean the collaboration with Bing Crosby?
Exactly. Bowie performed Peace on Earth, Little Drummer Boy with Bing Crosby for a CBS Christmas special. Bowie, the avant-garde bisexual rock god, standing next to the ultimate symbol of wholesome American culture.
The juxtaposition is just incredible.
And the fact that the single was released belatedly in 1982 and still hit UK number 3 proves the enduring power of that strange moment.
And the final piece of the triptych, Lodger from 79, moved away from the deep, icy minimalism of the first two.
It incorporated new wave and world music, and this is where he fully embraced chance as a creative tool. They used experimental techniques, notably Brian Eno's oblique strategies cards.
Right, the creativity cards designed to force artists out of their comfort zones.
An artistic randomizer, essentially. Imagine the tension in the studio when the instructions forced band members to swap instruments, like they did on Boys Keep Swinging.
It sounds like organized chaos, which, knowing Bowie, was probably the point.
It was. And this blending of structure and chance makes the trilogy a genuine masterpiece of avant-garde pop. The American composer Philip Glass summed it up best. He later adapted all three albums into his first, fourth, and 12th symphonies.
Wow.
And Glass praised Bowie's unique gift for creating fairly complex pieces of music, masquerading as simple pieces.
Having secured artistic redemption, the 1980s then heralded Bowie's commercial zenith. He began the decade with Scary Monsters and Super Creeps in 1980.
An album that successfully reintegrated the experimental edge of Berlin into a mainstream framework. Critics called it the perfect balance of creativity and commercial success.
It gave us the UK number one single, Ashes to Ashes, revisiting Major Tom.
Bringing him back down to earth, but addicted. And crucially, the video for that song was incredibly influential. It featured regulars from the London club Blitz and gave international exposure to the emerging new romantic movement.
It showed his knack for spotting and amplifying microtrends.
Always. Then we have the enormous 1981 collaboration with Queen on Under Pressure, his third UK number one hit. But the real calculated commercial explosion came with Let's Dance in 1983.
A deliberate pivot to commerciality.
Oh, absolutely. Co-produced by Nile Rodgers of Chic, this album was pure, polished pop alchemy. It went platinum in the UK and US. The title track hit number one, Modern Love, and China Girl hit number two in the UK. He essentially engineered himself into a global pop titan.
The production was impeccable, and it featured the searing guitar lines of a then-unknown Stevie Ray Vaughan.
Which gave the tracks this vital, raw energy beneath all that pop sheen. And crucially, this was the dawn of the MTV era, and Bowie seized that platform like a master strategist.
The Serious Moonlight tour followed, which was huge, and he understood the image was now as important as the sound.
We see that specifically in the music videos. The video for Let's Dance featured a narrative about an Aboriginal couple, serving as a subtle but clear statement against racism.
A conscious attempt to distance himself from the toxic ambiguity of the Thin White Duke era.
Exactly. And the sexually provocative China Girl video helped generate the heavy rotation that cemented his global superstar status.
Beyond music, the 80s were also marked by significant diverse acting roles.
He got critical praise for playing Joseph Merrick in the Broadway production of The Elephant Man, a deeply challenging role he did without stage makeup.
And then the film credits started racking up.
Yeah.
The Vampire and the Hunger in 83, Major Jack Sellers in Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence the same year.
Which critics consider among his finest acting performances. And of course, the cult classic. He starred as Jareth, the Goblin King, in Jim Henson's 1986 film, Labyrinth.
That film initially performed poorly, but became this absolute phenomenon on home video.
It introduced his theatricality to an entirely new generation. He even won his only non-posthumous Grammy for the short film, Jazzin' for Blue Jean.
But the relentless, highly polished pace of the 80s culminated in an inevitable creative dip. Bowie himself later called his final solo album of the decade, Never Let Me Down from 87.
His nadir, an awful album, were his words.
And the accompanying Glass Spider tour was criticized at the time as overproduced, pandering to stadium rock trend.
The very thing he'd been trying to escape by moving to Berlin a decade earlier. It was a sign that when Bowie became too successful, too polished, and too accepted, the need for radical, even destructive reinvention became his greatest artistic imperative once again.
So to shake off the excesses of the Glass Spider tour and that polished sound, Bowie did something radical. He temporarily shelved his name and formed the hard rock quartet Tin Machine in 1989. Yeah, with Reeves Gabrels on guitar and the rhythm section of brothers Tony and Hunt Sales, the intent was a radical rejection of solo fame. They intended to operate as a democracy, to get back to a raw, stripped-down band structure.
But was it really a democracy? The sources suggest Bowie still dominated the songwriting and decision-making.
Right. It sounds less like a back-to-basics band and more like just another persona where he pretended to cede control.
Was it just another form of reinvention, disguised as humanity?
It seems so. It was an essential psychological break for him, even if it was artistically controversial. Mm. The debut got mixed reviews. One critic called it pompous, dogmatic, and dull, with lyrics that preach against fascism and neo-Nazism.
A sincere attempt to tackle hard subjects, but the result wasn't universally beloved. Not at all. After mixed reception and some controversy over the album art for Tin Machine II, Bowie dissolved the band in 92, but he kept the key partnership with Reeves Gabrels for the rest of the decade, showing the value wasn't the band structure, but that collaborative energy.
And he'd already set the stage for his solo return with the commercially successful Sound Plus Vision Tour in 1990.
Where he focused entirely on his back catalog. So his official solo return in 1993, Black Tie, Wet Noise, immediately topped the UK chart. his fans were ready for him to come back.
This album, influenced by soul, jazz, and hip-hop, also dealt explicitly with the 1992 Los Angeles riots,
showing a newly engaged political commentary. And this era saw him dive headfirst into intense electronic experimentation. Outside in 1995 reunited him with Brian Eno, exploring these quasi-industrial sounds and a non-linear narrative of art and murder.
The music was challenging, abstract, and dark, a huge contrast to Lex Stance. He controversially toured with Nine Inch Nails,
which exposed him to a much younger, harder-edged alternative rock audience. Then, 2 years later, he embraced contemporary electronic subgenres with Earthling. He incorporated the frenetic, fast-paced rhythms of jungle and drum and bass.
For the learner, jungle and drum and bass are basically highly rhythmic, very fast-tempo forms of electronic music, emphasizing complex percussion.
And he managed to translate that intense sound into an accessible pop framework, producing the hit I'm Afraid of Americans, which was remixed by Trent Reznor and stayed on the U.S. Billboard charts for 16 weeks.
Beyond the studio, the 90s revealed Bowie not just as an artist, but as an extraordinarily shrewd businessman. He made an innovative financial move in 1997 that is still studied in finance schools.
The Bowie bonds.
That's not just finance, that's strategic control. He leveraged his past art to secure his future creative freedom. Can you break down the genius of the Bowie bonds?
It was revolutionary. He essentially sold asset-backed securities bonds based on the future revenues of 25 albums he recorded before 1990. Prudential bought these bonds for a massive $55 million U.S. dollars.
But the key insight is why he did it.
Exactly. He used that lump sum of upfront income specifically to buy back songs and master rights owned by his former troublesome manager, Tony DeFries.
So he leveraged his most famous work to gain control over his own legacy.
Precisely. The bonds liquidated in 2007, and the income rights reverted entirely back to Bowie. It proved his acute long-term strategy. And this period also saw his non-musical artistic pursuits flourish. He was a prolific painter, a serious art collector.
His collection was valued at over 10 million pounds in 2016.
He even dove into the burgeoning internet landscape, founding the ISP BowieNet and the website BowieArt.com, which allowed young artists to sell their work commission-free.
We should pause here and weave in the key personal themes that sustained him through this manic period, specifically his second marriage.
His second marriage in 1992 to Somali-American model Ayman was transformative. It was a deep, stabilizing force in his life that contrasted starkly with the chaos of his first marriage to Angie.
That relationship clearly inspired Black Tie White Noise.
Definitely, especially tracks like The Wedding Song. They welcomed a daughter, Alexandria, in 2000, and Edelman later confirmed that they led a quiet, private life primarily in New York and London.
And another critical personal theme we have to revisit is the enduring loyalty of his inner circle, particularly his personal assistant, Karine Coco Schwab.
Coco Schwab. She worked with him for 43 years, from 1973 until his death. Bowie called her his best friend and repeatedly credited her with literally saving his life during his worst drug addiction years in the 70s.
He left her $2 million in his will,
underscoring the value he placed on that decades-long friendship and support system.
Moving into the 21st century, the neoclassicist era began. He reunited with Tony Visconti to produce Heathen and Reality,
albums that marked his definitive exit from the heavy electronica of the 90s, settling into a more traditional reflective rock framework.
The subsequent, a reality tour in 2003-2004, was immense. It grossed more than any other tour in 2004.
A massive commercial success, but tragically, it also marked the abrupt end of his touring career.
In June 2004, while performing at a festival in Germany, he experienced chest pain. Initially, he thought it was a pinched nerve,
but it was quickly diagnosed as an acutely blocked coronary artery requiring emergency angioplasty. This forced the cancellation of the remaining tour dates, and Bowie never toured again.
His final live public performance was at a charity event in November 2006 alongside Alicia Keys. From that point on, he became intensely private.
He did, and before we move to the final act, it's worth reflecting on his complex relationship with spirituality, a theme that began with his half-brother Terry and the introduction to Buddhism.
He seriously considered becoming a Buddhist monk at one point.
He did. The famous anecdote is that his lama wisely told him, "You don't want to be Buddhist, you should follow music." His spiritual questioning remained a constant, vacillating between atheism, Gnosticism, and mysticism. His entire career, in many ways, was a metaphysical search expressed through popular culture.
After the abrupt end of touring in 2004 and his heart surgery, Bowie essentially retreated from public life for nearly a decade. This led to persistent speculation that he had quietly retired.
He became the ultimate recluse. And then came the surprise return.
On his 66th birthday in January 2013, he announced a new studio album the next day, which had been recorded entirely in secret. This album, his first to top the UK chart since 1993, became the fastest-selling album of 2013 at the time.
The secrecy was a massive part of the success. He proved he could still generate a huge cultural conversation without relying on modern publicity cycles. The album's success earned him the oldest ever Brit Award for British male solo artist. It was a defiant, joyful re-entry.
What the public didn't know was that in mid-2014, while he was enjoying this renewed success, Bowie was diagnosed with liver cancer.
A diagnosis he kept completely private, sharing it only with his closest family and collaborators. This context just fundamentally shifts how we view his final work.
It truly does. It makes the subsequent and final album, Black Star, a profound, deliberate artistic statement. His ultimate act of creative reinvention.
Black Star was released on his 69th birthday, January 8th, 2016, just 2 days before his death. Tony Visconti revealed that Bowie had intentionally planned the album as his swan song, a conscious parting gift for his fans.
The sources confirm the lyrics across the album clearly revolve around his impending mortality. The music video for Lazarus is particularly poignant. It shows him confined to a hospital bed, starting with that devastating line, "Look up here, I'm in heaven."
It was a dignified, self-curated farewell. He died 2 days later, on January 10th, 2016, in New York City. As he requested in his will, his ashes were scattered in Bali in a Buddhist ceremony, linking all the way back to his earliest spiritual influences.
The immediate aftermath saw record sales soar globally. Black Star debuted at number one in nearly every country, and within a week, an astonishing 19 of his albums were in the UK top 100.
Death itself became his final, massive commercial moment. Bowie's enduring reputation is cemented as the chameleon of rock, but that term almost undersells his influence. Billboard argued he influenced more musical genres than any other rock star.
Glam, folk, hard rock, electronic, industrial, synth pop.
He didn't just hop genres. He synthesized them, making the avant-garde palatable for millions. The BBC's arts editor even likened Bowie to Pablo Picasso for synthesizing complex concepts into coherent popular works.
His posthumous recognition confirms his long-term impact. At the 2017 Grammys, he swept all five nominated categories for Black Star.
Which, remarkably, were his first Grammy wins in musical categories.
And his legacy continues to be curated and studied. The David Bowie is Exhibition, which toured worldwide from 2013 to 2018, attracted nearly 2 million visitors.
In the film world, his influence is endless. The documentary Moonage Daydream was the first posthumous film approved by his estate. Even major filmmakers wanted him. Denis Villeneuve wanted to cast Bowie as the main villain in Blade Runner 2049.
He said Bowie embodied the Blade Runner spirit.
He did. And the final physical manifestation of his legacy will be the David Bowie Center, opening in September 2025 at the V&A East Storehouse in London, which will house over 90,000 items from his extraordinary life.
An archive dedicated not just to a musician, but to a perpetual performance artist.
What a profound journey we have traced. We've moved from David Robert Jones, the young Londoner struggling with insecurity and familial shadows, through the theatrical shock therapy of Ziggy Stardust and the dark, paranoid emptiness of the Thin White Duke.
Then the radical artistic cleansing in Berlin that resulted in some of the most complex, beautiful rock ever recorded, paving the way for the calculated pop behemoth of Let's Dance. We followed him through his astute business moves with the Bowie Bonds, and finally, the complex, emotional farewell of Black Star.
The key takeaway for you, the learner, is this. Bowie's success wasn't rooted in finding a style and sticking to it. It was rooted in the absolute commitment to dynamic self-disruption. His continuous reinvention and refusal to settle into one identity are what made him a cultural oracle.
He proved that profound artistic and personal growth often requires the courage to systematically destroy yesterday's successes.
Exactly. Identity, in Bowie's hands, was always mutable, always a project. What stands out is the strategic brilliance behind the changes, whether it was the aesthetic shock of Ziggy, the geographical cleanse of Berlin, or the financial mastery of the Bonds.
Bowie's work proves that identity itself can be the most valuable form of art and strategy. Every few years, he burned down the successful persona and started anew, synthesizing different genres and cultural ideas into a cohesive whole.
So here is the provocative thought for you to carry forward. What aspect of your own life or your professional expertise are you ready to radically reinvent next?